From KCUR News, this is Casey Kearns, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan.
On this week's show, as registration for Google Fiber wraps up, we take a look at the digital divide in our community.
The main barrier is cost. So you either have a cost barrier or you have a hardware barrier. It's hard for people that we serve to get onto the on-ramp.
Plus the latest in our Odd Jobs series, or maybe this time we should call it our Sweet Jobs series, going to concerts, meeting bands, and writing about it.
Yeah, I don't think any of it's hard, because I like doing it, and I like meeting the people in the local scene.
And a local play that's promoting important sex education messages to youth.
Sexuality for kids, like anybody, like adults too, but it's so much about identity, so much about loneliness, so much about trying to fit in.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. This is Casey Currents. I'm Suzanne Hogan.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Kansas City leaders were thrilled when they beat out 1,100 other cities for something called Google Fiber. Now residents are competing to bring the blazing fast internet services to their neighborhood first. The search engine company is building an infrastructure to offer household internet speeds 100 times faster than they currently get and has also rolled out its own TV offering.
But Google is doing things differently than traditional internet providers. As KCUR's Maria Carter reports, they are asking people to compete and collaborate.
Yvette Roberts is one of about a dozen people stopping at a Google Fiber registration event in the basement of St. James Church. She says she didn't know what Google Fiber was when she saw it in the church newsletter. She puts her most pressing question to Google's Luke Carlson.
The major thing that I need to know is that, do you guys have the NFL package?
We have the NFL Network and the NFL Red Zone as of right now.
She'd be less excited to find out Google hasn't signed on some other big channels like ESPN to their lineup. They say they're working on it. Google's doing things differently than most cable and internet companies. Google's Kevin Lowe says they're having people in Kansas City do the market research for them.
Rather than us decide where and when we should build, we decided, hey, let's ask Kansas Cityans and ask them to let us know their interest by literally going to a website and pre-registering.
Google will only bring its fiber service to neighborhoods where enough people pay the $10 registration fee. They're relying on excited customers like Roberts, who plans to get in touch with her neighbors.
Almost definitely, I will be sending text messages to make sure that they get down to the location where the sign-up is for our neighborhood.
If Roberts can't get enough of her neighbors to sign up, then Google won't bring the fiber optic cable to her neighborhood. Google's calling this approach a rally, and it looks like a grassroots political campaign, complete with yard signs, flyers, and enthusiastic supporters. Heck, they even have a pair of ice cream trucks rolling around town to drum up support.
Brownie ice cream sandwich.
At a sign-up event outside a local community center, Tanya Sippel grabs a plate of barbecue. She volunteers for the city parks department, but faced a problem when she tried to sign up.
I brought cash, and they said they need debit, and we don't have a debit card at this time.
Workers tell her she can get a Visa gift card at the Walgreens across the street and use it to register. This is just one of the challenges Google faces in trying to cross the so-called digital divide. Google's research shows about a quarter of all Kansas Cityans don't have broadband at home, and that skews by race, education, and income. Google's Kevin Lowe says it comes down to two basic factors, relevance and affordability.
Not to say that it's certainly not Google's role to solve the entire problem, but we really wanted to take advantage of this opportunity to do what we can. It's something that's very important to a lot of Googlers.
And what they're doing is offering something they call free internet. It's not super fast, and it's not exactly free. Customers are expected to pay the $300 installation fee. Then they get normal broadband speeds for 7 years. Christopher Barnacle is the assistant director at the Kansas City, Kansas Public Library, where many people now come to use the internet. He says affordability is only part of the problem.
And then there's just the fact of the matter that certain people don't have computers in the homes. And if you don't have computers, what good does the internet.
Whether enough people in all neighborhoods will sign on is still being decided. Google recently made it easier for some places, lowering the number of signups needed to get service. After complaints, some homes were empty. Maria Carter, KCUR News.
And as the deadline to register for Fiberhoods wraps up, we look at the looming issue in our community, the digital divide in the Kansas City area. If you are a low-income resident of the urban core of Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri, you are less likely to have internet connection. According to Google's recent study, 42% of the Kansas City market with incomes of less than $25,000 did not use the internet. Being disconnected from the internet's wide world of information leaves many urban residents, students, and job seekers far behind their more affluent neighbors.
So that's why Google plans to bring lightning speed internet connectivity to Kansas City. It's viewed by many as part of a solution to the digital divide. But not so fast. There have been challenges to linking the information highway to poor communities. To learn more about the barriers and solutions, I hosted a roundtable discussion here at the KCUR studios. And today we have with us
Chepto Kositan Buckner, Deputy Director, Kansas City Public Library.
Donovan Mouton, a development and real estate consultant, formerly of One Economy Corporation, which was a not-for-profit that dealt with the digital divide and bring technology to low-income households.
I'm Michael Limata. I'm president of Connecting for Good, a local broadband advocacy group.
Well, thank you for being with us today. Why is bridging the divide, linking up the poor and primarily minority neighborhoods to technology, why is that so important?
I think technology is very important for economic development, education, and just living and existing in this society. And I think bridging the divide is very, very important because most of the jobs require online applications. If you're looking for employment, you must be able to have access to a computer and the internet. That in itself makes it very important.
Just to follow up with that, libraries play a really important role in that regard for low-income residents. What's the role of the library in reducing the digital divide?
Libraries have always been the technology access points for those people who do not have internet access at home or computers. When you walk into our libraries right now, we have over 700 public computers. We offer free Wi-Fi in our libraries. We see usage of our computers, over 700,000 users a year. Internet access, over a million people a year. That is very, very, very important. Also, a number of our libraries are in the underserved areas of Kansas City. And you can tell that we are the only access points for those people who don't have internet access at home. Donovan and One Economy and a number of community groups are really have been working together for years, and Google Fiber is going to maybe allow us to do this, which is to take all these services that the library is offering, from computer access to internet access to digital literacy to services for the unemployed, to other spaces, community centers, public housing, any place that the community uses as a gathering place, we can certainly push library services that way.
Which is a nice segue into asking you the same question, Donovan. Why is this digital divide reduction so important?
Well, the internet provides information, and information is like oxygen for people. As Chipto indicated, it's the gateway to education, economic development, jobs, and healthcare, all kinds of other resources that if we can provide that to low-income households, that gives them a foothold in being on the same pedestal as other individuals who already get it. During my tenure at One Economy, we brought internet access to over 800 households in Kansas City, primarily low-income multifamily housing developments, some that are along Armour Boulevard specifically. I'm also chair of the Kansas City Housing Authority Board of Commissioners, and we have over 3,000 housing units, public housing units, throughout the Metroplex. Bringing information to those particular households and access can improve people's lives. But the main barrier is costs. So you either have a cost barrier or you have a hardware barrier. So with that barrier in place, it's hard for people that we serve to get onto the on-ramp, similar to other people who can't already do it. The digital haves and have-nots, basically.
Michael, how about you?
Well, I think the problem is that we have in the city what I would call digital black holes. You know, if you look along State Line in some of the more affluent areas, I mean, people are living what I would call a digital lifestyle. I mean, I have my BlackBerry in my pocket right now. I can check my email. I can check anything I want. In my home, my wife and I each have a tablet PC. We each have a smartphone. We each have a laptop, and we each have a desktop computer. So it's kind of crazy, but in some ways, the internet is like just in my pocket, you might say. And yet there are people today who are completely left out of this digital opportunity and digital revolution that we're experiencing today. I mean, when we talk about Google Fiber being 100 times faster than what's available now, I'm afraid that unless a lot of things happen proactively, the digital divide is going to be 100 times bigger. And that disparity between the haves and have-nots is going to be even worse. I really equate connectivity with opportunity. So what's happening is people are stuck when there's this whole world of opportunity that would be at their fingertips if they were connected.
And I would add that the digital have-nots have more of a tendency to be in line rather than online because they don't have the information, so they go to some place to look for what they need and find out it's not there, and they're in line, they have to get in another line, so it ends up wasting all their time.
Catchy slogan, in line, not online.
Yes.
Huh? Schools have been also an access point for low-income residents. What about that strategy in as far as getting more people connected?
In Wyandotte County, Kansas City, Kansas Public School District, there's close to 6,000 laptops, Apple PCs, Apple MacBooks that go home every night. But I would also venture to say that many of those homes that those computers are going to don't have access at home. It's a very effective strategy. It's a great way of shifting resources from paying for textbooks to do laptops, but access is one of the big issues.
We just recently have been focusing our attentions with Connecting for Good on Rosedale Ridge, which is a 250-unit complex, federal housing complex in Kansas City, Kansas. And we did a survey working with the Kansas City Youth Center, and they found out that 80% of the residents in that development do not have internet access, and mostly because the average income is about $10,000. And of kids who take home laptops from the KCK schools, only 1 in 3 was able to actually connect at home.
It's where the excitement is right now among our young people and accessing technology. However, though, we're not creating that next public benefit to get them online.
Now, I know, Michael, in your neck of the woods, you had a proposal for Google that was kind of turned down, but you're continuing efforts to get an e-community center. Do you want to talk about that some?
Yeah, well, actually, we originally had this idea of a Wi-Fi co-op, and now we're trying to do things with free Wi-Fi, which I think is going to be more acceptable. And so part of our first initiatives is to work in the Rosedale Ridge apartment complex to get that whole community wired. And we're also looking at other places where we can set up, with the fiber to do training.
Thinking about the community engagement theme, I know that this whole Paint the Town Green movement with Aaron Deacon, they were raising money to pay the $10 fees. But some people criticize that and say that's really manufactured green.
This is Chapter from the Kansas City Public Library. I wouldn't consider it manufactured. I would consider it an incentive. I would consider it an opportunity to educate people on what they are missing and what they are going to benefit by doing that. That's the way we looked at it at the as the library. There are a number of people from the community who are coming in to sign up, not because they wanted Google Fiber at their home, but they wanted to make sure the library gets it so their children will have access to Google Fiber. I mean, everybody has some kind of access to some kind of technology. What they cannot afford is that connectivity. So I think I didn't look at it as manufactured, but more of as an incentive and an educational opportunity.
Yeah, well, I think that ultimately it was a sign of community interest and support, and that's what they were looking for. I think Paint the Town Green, we managed to raise about $10,000 with it. At least one thing Google does know is that we really care and we want to see that you know, this is happening in our community. I think there is an issue, though, and that is that even though they have set this low bar of $300 a year or $25 a month, there are some still people who aren't going to be able to do that. You know, most of the low-income people that we deal with are not homeowners, they're renters. And so how can you expect somebody who's, you know, a transient person renting an apartment for a year to come up with $300 that will benefit the people who come after them?
This is Susan Wilson on KC Currents, and we're talking about the digital divide in Kansas City. When you look at the numbers, you know, 42% of the Kansas City market with low incomes didn't use the internet, and 46% of African Americans don't use it, and 1/4 of the city doesn't have broadband. What about this need for digital literacy?
It's critical, and it's the one thing that needs to be part of a comprehensive program for getting people connected. It has to include both literacy, affordable access, and also hardware.
In terms of digital literacy, that role is one of the roles we look at the library as the key in this particular place. I mean, we are a place for information about reading, about creating knowledge in the community, and certainly we plan to take that role in terms of being the leader in digital literacy. We are not doing that just because of Google Fiber, though. We've been doing that for a while. As soon as e-book readers come out, you know, tablets, you know, different kind of phones, digital cameras, the first place people usually call for that kind of information is the library. We are going to make it much more accessible now moving forward, knowing that we have Google Fiber coming in and getting more people to have the right information and useful information to help them move forward. If people have cell phones, we can deliver information and training to their cell phone through an app. We can make it accessible to them.
And I think you mentioned, Susan, about our plan for e-community centers. We've talked about, we've already lined up programs for people to begin training in digital literacy. And we've also talked a little bit with the KCK Library about creating virtual branches that would be, in a sense, libraries without bookshelves, where people can use tablet PCs, notebooks, and that's how they would access the information to the library.
Well, I know you talked about a comprehensive plan that includes hardware. Isn't that a major barrier still in terms of there just aren't many folks in the urban core who actually own computers in the first place?
Well, during my tenure with One Economy, and through my experience in bringing broadband to low-income households in Kansas City, if you solve either of these particular barriers, access or hardware, if you solve the access issue that makes it affordable for low-income households to either have free or affordable access, they find a way to get the hardware, or vice versa. I set up a digital loan fund at Central Bank when I was with One Economy, which still exists, which basically allows a low-income household to apply for a loan to either buy a used laptop or a new PC and pay it off over a 2-year period. No interest, no fees, just basically apply for it, and then they get a computer. So basically, there's innovative strategies of how to deal with both.
I think also that, you know, looking at the hardware divide when you're just thinking about a desktop is something that we need to probably leap over. I think access points are going to be your tablets and they're going to be your cell phones. And so I think the desktop limitation is going to live for a little bit longer before the primary access point is your tablet and your cell phone. In the U.S., I originally come from Kenya, and the way people use their cell phones in the rest of the world is phenomenal. In Kenya, for instance, almost everybody I see has a cell phone. They can send money, they can receive money, they can get healthcare information, they can do so many things with that. And it's only a matter of time before we as the U.S. get to that point of where the primary device is not the desktop.
Yeah, the Pew actually Center for Internet and Society did a recent study that said 65% of minority people have a smartphone. And that's actually one area of technology where they're actually keeping up with majority communities. And I think that part of, I think, bridging the digital divide is understanding, well, how do you take that a step further and help them to become better users?
You know, Google has said, quote, "We'd love to be able to solve the digital divide ourselves. We can't." So is it unrealistic to think that Google was going to come in and solve the digital divide issue single-handedly? Are people expecting too much?
They are a business. They're a business just like AT&T and Time Warner. However, though, with the public sector support that occurred on both sides of the state line, that's definitely the responsibility of the public sector to help do that, because it flows with all their other goals related to economic development, to job creation, to neighborhood improvement. So I don't fault Google, but it is definitely a public sector goal and responsibility to help solve this particular issue.
And I do think there is an issue where community groups do need to help them understand our situation. Over and over again, I'm just reminded that nobody knows our community like we do. In some ways, we can't expect them to understand the challenges that we face and the barriers that might be out there.
I think we all knew, we all agree that Google is a commercial company, just like any company that is opening anywhere in any of our United States of America. But I think, more importantly, it gives this region a competitive edge. It does, and with all the barriers, it gives us one step. We are a step ahead of most cities now by having Google Fiber in our city.
Some people say, well, I don't understand why I need internet that fast. Is it, you know, killing a fly with a...
well,
a hammer.
A hammer, yes, thank you.
Maybe a cannon.
I mean, is it a marketable concept to think that people would need internet that fast?
They might not need it now at your home, but you'll need it in the future. You look at the path of the internet from the 90s when we had GOFA, it was a text system. We've moved on. We about, you know, 10, 15, we didn't have YouTube and videos. We are getting to the point of where our bandwidth is going to need to expand in order for us to be able to push that content. From a library standpoint, we have a lot of content. We are digitizing collections. We are taking photographs and turning them into a digital format. Those take up a lot of space and require a lot of bandwidth to push it out there.
It's the first time that we've seen a true integration with video and IP services. It's kind of a indication of the total future of what we'll be doing online. I mean, we're moving to a place, and even using this public utility analogy is a good one, because the truth is, internet access with this kind of a pipe is going to be pretty much the way we live and do business in a few years.
Bridging this digital divide is going to be expensive. Is it fair to ask Google to give its product away free to large numbers of urban residents that may not be able to cover the cost?
I don't think Google should be required to give it away free. But I do believe that there needs to be increased flexibility so that we can bridge and create all those neighborhoods east of Truce as green and those in Wyandotte County. Also, it could be a game changer. It could also help encourage other telcos like Time Warner and AT&T to also be flexible to help bridge that divide, make it more of a collaboration of various telecoms here in Kansas City to make accessibility more affordable.
And I think that there is a role to have some concession because the city governments themselves have made concessions to Google. I mean, they're doing what they're doing for millions of dollars less than they would have in other cities because of the concessions made, for instance, by the Board of Public Utilities and KCK.
If they are going to be those digital halls, as somebody mentioned earlier, that is where I think the library can bridge. I think having the library connected at that particular time and having the schools connected, those people who do not have Google or fiber at their home can take advantage of the library. I would like to make a plug for Google in terms of, we keep on saying Google Fiber should be given free, but Google is free in itself in terms of the search engine has been free, Google Docs has been free. And so in this initiative where they are getting into infrastructure, they've given us an opportunity to connect some of the most important entities in our community, but also give Kansas City, Kansas and Kansas City, Missouri an opportunity that can really change our lives in terms of economic development, education, and healthcare.
How much do you think Google stumbled into some old and still persistent racial and socioeconomic wounds that are related to the truce divide?
I don't necessarily fault Google. There's been a strong public sector partnership on the Google initiative in both communities. And the public sector knows this, that they know this history. Real estate growth patterns in this community have been dictated by it for decades. You know, at one point in time, African Americans did not live south of 27th Street, and then that barrier erased, and now they're further south, but truce has been persistent. So I would not fault Google for that. We know our community best. The public sector was a very willing partner in this whole initiative. They are the ones who sponsored the application. So I guess in some ways I'm saying the public sector, in terms of our governments, should have been on the forefront of making sure Google was aware of that history and coming up with early solutions to deal with it.
I also think that none of us, or even the community or Google, had enough time to educate people about how to actually do this. When we had Google was going to come, we as a library reached out to Google because we knew how important it was to the community. Again, I think if there was time to educate everybody, that everybody would have jumped on board. We knew because we, I mean, one of the numbers that I have is that usage of our bandwidth at the library is over $1 billion a year for people using our bandwidth to connect. So we knew getting that bandwidth was critical to what we were doing, and we jumped on board and engaged Google. We did not wait for Google to engage us.
The take that I have on the situation with the truce dividing line is it's no surprise whatsoever. To us, we've known that for over a year that it was going to happen. But the question is, you know, what will we do? It's just, to me, it emphasizes again how much more effort has to be put out, how much more education and outreach has to happen.
And I would comment that when Google came on board, I mean, the first initial meetings, Google said, what we are providing you is this infrastructure. It's up to the community to figure out.
They were very clear about that.
It was very clear at the beginning. Yeah. It's up to the community.
And I think that's the key to the whole thing. Nothing like this has ever been done before.
Yeah.
And even the executives and leadership at Google is sort of flying by the seat of their pants as this thing is moving forward. And I think the whole idea is for community leaders and activists to stay on top of this, to make sure that our voice is heard and that we're engaged in a way that our needs are going to be met.
What's the most important next focus in terms of reducing the digital divide?
We have a gaggle of people who are moving forward on the technology superhighway, and there's this black hole of people who are not. And we'll wake up one day and we'll have this increasing population of individuals and households that are not part of it. So literacy, I think, is critical. And the library can't do that by themselves. They also need resources in order to do that. And while the school district can play a great role in that also. But as I mentioned earlier, Kansas City, a school district, has 6,000 laptops that go home every night. Kansas City, Missouri school district, none, zero. So they need to get in the game.
I think the thing about it, too, is the fact that there are still going to be people who can't afford even the lowest rate. And so it's up to us to be creative and to find ways to still deliver bandwidth to them?
I mean, internally in the library, we are going to create an internal task force to begin thinking about opportunities for Google Fiber within the library. But I think for the larger community is getting together a community working group that will sit down with entrepreneurs and economic developers, civic leaders, and begin to really hone in on how we take advantage of Google. How do we become innovative with Google? How do we really make it so important to us that is that everybody in the world knows Kansas City? It doesn't matter whether it's Kansas City, Kansas, or Kansas City, Missouri. Kansas City is Google Fiber City, and they are doing some marvelous things. Just the way they're talking about the Performing Center, or they're talking about the library programming, or everything that is going out there, we need to be the Fiber City in the world, and it's taking advantage of it, and we're taking our community to the next level.
Yeah.
That was Chepto Kasatani-Buckner, Deputy Director of the Kansas City Public Library, Michael Limita, co-founder of Connecting for Good, and Donovan Mouton, a Kansas City real estate developer.
Stay tuned to KCUR and KC Currents for future developments on the digital divide. Coming up, going to concerts and hanging out with bands as a job? Hear the latest installment in our Odd Job series. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Suzanne Hogan.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
If you spend any amount of time going to concerts or music shows in Kansas City, you've probably seen a tall, thin man with a shock of gray hair, usually standing by himself, often near the back of the club. He might say hi to passing friends, but this guy's a lot more tuned in to the music than your typical concert goer. And he should be. He's working. For the past 16 years, Tim Finn has been the pop music editor for the Kansas City Star. This week, he's the subject of our latest installment in our occasional Odd Job series.
When Tim Finn went to college at MU in the 80s, he was, he admits, kind of a music snob. He was a devotee of 80s punk rock and early alternative rock like The Replacements and R.E.M. But as he started writing about music, he wound up getting assigned to cover bands he'd never listened to on his own. He told Alex Smith that eventually an assignment to cover a heavy metal band opened his eyes and changed the way he thought about music.
Probably the show, one of the more pivotal shows I ever saw. Metallica came to Sandstone, and this was back in the late 90s, probably 97 maybe 98. I'd heard them, you know, but I didn't devour them. I didn't listen to them. I knew some of their music, and I had friends who listened to them casually. So my impression of them was pretty naive and uninformed. They offered me an interview with, you know, James Hetfield, the guitar player, and I took it. Frankly, I was a little nervous about it as I prepared for it because I had no sound perception of him or who he was. And the music is aggressive and angry, and so I didn't know what I was expecting. But did the interview, and he turned out to be one of the nicest guys I've ever interviewed, just a real down-to-earth, funny, witty, friendly guy. So that sort of changed things a little bit. And then I went to the show, and like I said, I've come around to like them now, A. And B, what I appreciated was, A, how they treated their fans, how they acted on stage, how humble they seemed, and how much they showed their appreciation for their fans, and likewise, the way the fans acted. Because I remember turning around, and there were 18,000 people there. Nobody was leaving their seats to go get beer. You know, there was just a lot of respect and the ferocity of the response. And I remember thinking, I don't think I've ever gone to a show to see a band I've really loved and witnessed this kind of response. And it was just pretty transforming. And yeah, it showed me they love their music just as much as I love mine. Nobody's, you know, there's no right or wrong answers. You can argue some intellectual points about what's artistically better or more influential. But I think when it comes to live music, you show up, you have a great time. And no matter who it is, if that's what happens, then mission accomplished, you know?
Uh-huh. That sounds like a big difference from a lot of the punk bands like in the 80s who wouldn't necessarily like show a lot of respect for their audience.
Right. Because probably, you know, I saw The Replacements once and it was just, it was a mess. It was kind of beyond disappointing, you know, you felt disrespected. And I'd seen R.E.M. a couple times, and like I said, the difference between what I saw at that Metallica show and what I'd seen before, it woke me up. And I sort of killed my snooty hipster, I can't believe you like that stuff, or, you know, that stuff's beneath me. I just became a little more, I'm more about, you know, just have something you're passionate about, some kind of music, and, you know, it starts there.
So what are the styles or maybe genres that you have kind of struggled the most to learn to appreciate?
Hardcore rap, and it's not because I don't appreciate it. There's a lot of skills. I started out listening to songwriters, and lyrics became important. So I think, you know, you want to feel like you're being spoken to or someone's connecting with you and your life and your history or your lifestyle. I grew up in a really small town. I don't connect lyrically with a lot of hardcore rap. I can appreciate it. I've been to several shows. I sort of watch and appreciate all the energy. And I mean, lyrically, that stuff is, some of it's amazing. But I don't feel it, you know, viscerally. So that's one. Really, you know, the hair metal is cartoonish. It's amusing, but I never really connected with that. I guess, you know, I can appreciate just about anything. There's also this genre of bands who, how do I put this? It's they're pretty vanilla and they're trying to be very R&B, Motown, soulful, and they're not. And I have a problem with that. It's pretty milquetoast stuff. There's usually a handsome guy singing, pretending he's Luther Vandross or Marvin Gaye or something, and it doesn't work for me, you know. Few guys can pull that off, you know, and I can name bands like Matchbox 20 and Maroon 5 and Train, or those are the ones where, nope, it's just not happening.
When you were first starting to write for The Star, what was the pop music writing like?
Well, it focused widely on, as I remember, national events, and we still do. But it seemed to be almost exclusively that because, you know, I mean, I would interview a lot of people coming to Kemper Arena or Sandstone, a lot of the big bands. Back then, I mean, you could have access. If David Bowie did an interview with the New York Times, maybe you could read it, but maybe he talked to Rolling Stone. But there wasn't, obviously now you can find information on people like him anywhere, all over the place, and a lot of it's redundant. So I think back then the imperative was more like, let's cover our local scene, the national events in our local scene, the big concerts, the people coming. If we can snag an interview with, you know, anybody, somebody in Aerosmith or somebody in Springsteen's band or whoever, there was a lot more of that. And that's probably the thing that has changed the most over the last 5, maybe even 10 years is shifting our focus to the local scenes and the local bands.
Now, there are, you know, obviously lots of kinds of musical writing. There are people who, you know, want to try to promote bands or scenes, and then there's others who kind of work as critics. How do you see your role at The Star?
Well, that's changed a lot. You know, I think what I like doing most now, and this goes back to what I said before about the local scene, because it's so vibrant right now, and I like writing about the people in it, the musicians, the songwriters, the guys in the bands, because almost everyone is, it's a sacrifice of time and money and sometimes relationships. It's a lot of work. Everybody's usually working other jobs. It's a mission of love. It's, you know, most of them tell me I've stopped doing it, but I can't quit, you know, when I'm not doing it just because it's become too inconvenient or, you know, people get married, have kids, or, you know, things happen, bands break up. But it seems like everybody comes back because it's so innate to them. And it's all about, you know, loving what they're doing. And there are so many really talented musicians in this town. And I've just over the last few years just started to write about them. And that's what I like doing the most. Informing readers about, you know, a show they could go to, maybe spend $7. It's at a small club. And you're going to enjoy this as much as any arena show if you put your mind to it. So there's that element to it. On the other side of that is, you know, we used to do a lot of like album reviews and CD reviews to try to get people to make them aware of stuff that's coming out. But the way music is released now, that whole concept has just been kind of shot because, you know, people ask me, well, what do you think of this record? Are you going to write about it? And I say, well, you can go listen to it. You can decide on your own. I mean, I can tell you what I think about it, but right now I don't think there's a better way to figure out whether you like a CD or a band, then it's right there for you, you know? It's like, why tell me to describe that plate of food? Why don't you just eat it and see if you like it?
So you've been going to shows, you know, very regularly for decades now. I wonder if you have, like, a best show or, you know, maybe a couple best shows that you've ever seen.
I do. Radiohead is at the top of the list, and I've seen them 3 times now. I saw them in St. Louis in 2003. It was the first time I'd seen them. I was set up to be kind of blown away, and I was. The show was really hyped to me, like, this is going to be like something you've never seen. I was a little skeptical I was going to like it that much, but I did. I liked it more than that. They came here in April, I think, or March. I guess it was March. But I'd seen them in St. Louis two nights before, and that show was as good as that other St. Louis show I saw. The one here was good, but a very different show. So Radiohead is one. Prince played at Kemper Arena, I think, in 1998, and I was in like the fifth row, and he is just one of the greatest live performers I've ever seen. There was a show I saw, David Byrne came to Memorial Hall, I think, and it was 2001. Not very many people showed up. The place holds like 3,300. There might have been 800 people there. They just let everybody on the floor, and he just lit the fuse and let it go. And I just remember, kind of because of those circumstances and what the set list he put out, that it was one of those shows where I buzzed about it for a couple days. And it was not this big, epic, you know, sold-out arena show. It was kind of just a show that either got lost or just, you know, I was surprised at how small the crowd was, but it ended up that it didn't matter because he really took charge of the place, and it was a blast.
Well, do you have, like, a worst show that you have seen?
Oh, well, yeah, and it was because of well, actually, yes, no doubt. It was the show that, it was Matchbox 20 and Train together, so, but it was the Sunday after September 11th. They didn't cancel the show. They weren't playing baseball or football then, but the show went on for some reason. And it was awful, and people were acting like nothing was wrong. Or, you know, and their excuse was, hey, we need to kind of forget about things. And I went out there thinking that it wasn't going to happen, or, you know, nobody would show up. But there were probably 12,000 people there, and it was like nothing had ever happened. And yeah, it was awful. I hated being there. I don't like those bands anyway, but that was definitely the first, you know, on the top of the list.
Mm-hmm. How often these days do you see shows?
It can be it's usually no more than four a week. That's a lot. Two to three is average. You know, it depends on the schedule. You know, the live scene has its seasons. You know, summer's busier. The outdoor venues are working. So there was a stretch recently, I think I did like four and six nights, and it's kind of grueling, but I'm out there watching people like music. It's not hard, but it takes time, and they're late hours and early mornings, so four is plenty in a week.
Mm-hmm. And you wear earplugs?
I don't, but my hearing's fine. I make sure I'm as far enough away as I can be. You know, a lot of times I always put a set list in the review, which requires that I hear some lyrics if I don't know a song. And with earplugs, I can't. And I can't pick up, you know, I like to hear the music, and the earplugs distract me, and I can't hear what I want to hear. So there are some times, there was a show, I've stood outside the room sometimes because, like, at the Midland or the Uptown, because it's so crushingly loud, even in the back of the room. But that I have to be outside the room. One was a Chemical Brothers show at the Uptown, and then Motorhead played at the Midland. And there were local musicians, guys in bands who play in loud rock bands, who were like running out of the room at that one because it was just punishing.
So how has live music in Kansas City changed since you started covering it?
Well, there are more venues on both ends. There's more theaters doing big shows. You know, we have the Sprint Center, we have the Midland and the Uptown. The Voodoo Lounge at Harris Casino is a big room. The Crossroads KC behind Grinders, that holds like they can put 3,000 people in that place. So there are more rooms and venues doing shows. By far, there's a lot more. And then at the smaller level, there are more clubs doing shows. So any night, there is usually, I can look at the calendar and think, yeah, I would go to this tonight. And it's rare that there's not something going on. There are a lot more local bands now, and a lot more good local bands.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you seen trends in local music or concerts in the past few years that you really don't like?
Starting late. And I don't know if that's a trend or if it's always been that way. And I wrote about this a few months ago, how it would be nice if, you know, a lot of the smaller clubs will put the opener on at 10 or 10:30, and sometimes they have three bands, which means the headliner doesn't go on until after midnight. And there's a reason for it. And one of the reasons is that people think, well, nobody goes out before 9, or, you know, people don't start going out till 10 o'clock. You don't want the headliner coming on. The two people will miss the first two bands. There's probably something to that. However, You know, when Radiohead comes to town or Wilco comes to town, the show starts at 7:30 or 8, and people show up and fill the place. So people are accustomed to going to a show like it's a movie or whatever at 7:30, maybe skip the opener and watch the headliner at 8:45 or 9 o'clock and going home at 11:30. I wish there were more of that. I think it hurts attendance. The club owners want people in there, you know, buying food and drinks, and they don't want people emptying the place at 11:30. That's a dynamic, and I don't know if there's an answer, but I think off the bat, I would say I wish more shows started at a reasonable hour.
So what's the hardest part of your job?
I don't think any of it's hard. I think the part that I wish I could cover more, there's so much to write about and getting to it because there's so much more to do. The whole, you know, there's so much more to take care of, whether it's the blog or the social media, and there's just a lot more little work to do. And that takes away from doing bigger stories. I would like to do more big stories, more profiles, and then covering the shows, the live shows, because there used to be two people doing this. There hasn't been for a while, but it could definitely be a two-person job. That would be great. The freelancers probably add up to half a person, you know, maybe. So that helps. But I don't think any of it's hard because I like doing it, and I like meeting the people in the local scene, and I like writing about it. I like writing about the local scene more than just promoting another big name band that's coming to the Sprint Center that doesn't really necessarily need the promotion. You just need to let people know they're going to be there.
You know? Well, so what's the best part of your job?
Being at a show where people are going crazy. It helps if I like the band. And I would say that Radiohead show in St. Louis, which I went to on my own, didn't write about it, and we were really close to the stage and just getting swept up in the enthusiasm and, you know, the transcendence of the show. And it's, it can be spiritual. Definitely, it can be at the right moment, at the right time, the right band. That's the best part.
Tim Finn, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Tim Finn is pop music editor for the Kansas City Star. If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
Coming up, a local play highlights sex education. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan. In area news this week, Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver was a hit at the Democratic National Convention, and Kansas City St. Joseph Bishop Robert Finn became the highest-ranking Catholic official to ever be convicted of a criminal offense. KCUR's Steve Bell looks back at those and other top stories of the week.
Plans for a trial for the Kansas City St. Joseph Diocese and its bishop suddenly changed on Wednesday. No jury would hear the case. A judge would review the facts and rule on them the following day. Prosecutor Jean Peters Baker explained,
"We did not have to drag parents into a courtroom to have them identify photographs of their children. For us, that is a huge, huge win."
The court put the onus on the bishop. Charges against the diocese were dismissed, and Bishop Robert Finn was convicted of failure to report suspected sexual abuse of a child. Finn delivered a short statement to the court and the public.
"I truly regret and am sorry for the hurt that these events have caused."
The sentence was 2 years probation, plus stipulations that Finn would provide child abuse recognition and reporting training for priests and others he oversees, and establish a $10,000 fund to provide counseling for victims. David Clossy of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests said that after decades of scandal, it's about time a bishop was punished.
"It's a historic moment. Finally, a top church official is being held responsible by the U.S. justice system for his role in child sex crimes."
On Friday, the abuse survivors group picketed the diocesan headquarters, calling for Finn to be rebuked and demoted by the Vatican. Many delegates didn't know who Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver was when he stepped to the rostrum Wednesday night at the Democratic National Convention. But before he'd finished his speech, the Kansas City lawmaker and minister had the crowd on its feet with a revivalesque message about hope and unity.
"We are one. We may be poor, we may be rich, but we are one. We may be up or we may be down, but we are one. We may be up, we may be down, we are one.
Cleaver, who is chair of the House Black Caucus, said he was talking to all Americans, not just Democrats. This is KCUR.
One in four Americans who test positive for HIV is 20 years old or younger. Among Kansas City's most visible prevention efforts is the Dramatic Health Education Project, which is celebrating 20 years of delivering messages about sexual responsibility to area youth. As the Coterie Theater is a partner in the project, it is marking the anniversary with a production of a rock musical, Spring Awakening, based on a controversial play written in 1891 about the importance of sex education. KCUR's Steve Walker reports.
The KU School of Nursing and UMKC Schools of Medicine and Pharmacy first partnered with the Coterie Theater in 1992 to design what was called the Dramatic AIDS Education Project. At that time, HIV was still a subject spoken of in hushed tones, and the group saw increasing numbers of youth being impacted by the disease. They asked local playwright Lisa Cortez to write a script with a strong HIV prevention message that schools might host.
I remember having this matrix I worked from in terms of the specific information to get out, the specific factual information. Plus, we had to design it so that we had two different messages, one an abstinence message and one a prevention safe sex message. But it had to be done in a really interesting way.
Though HIV information has changed over the decades, the format for the project has remained consistent. A male and female stand before a slideshow and talk about their characters' feelings and mistakes regarding sex and sexuality, as in this clip from a new documentary about the project.
The only person I can blame now is myself. We didn't do drugs. We drank alcohol, which is a pretty huge drug, but we didn't shoot anything or use any needles. We just had sex.
One of the performers is always an actor now, and one a medical student. Julie Banderas, professor of medicine at UMKC, is one of the project's co-directors and responsible for recruiting the med students. She says some of them are initially nervous about performing beside a real actor, but have found the experience meaningful.
That's the thing that scares them the most. They say, I can't do this because I'm not an actor, but you don't have to be an actor. You're just telling a story. They're interested in reaching out to adolescents and telling them things that maybe they wish they would have known.
Lisa Cortez sees the importance of the project not in the medical details, but in a wider lens focused on the nature of human sexuality itself.
Sexuality for kids, like anybody, like adults too, but it's so much about identity, so much about loneliness, so much about trying to fit in, so much about trying to find their place in the world. So those parts of the stories just kind of live there without, separate from the information.
That very philosophy is at the heart of Frank Vatican's 1891 play, Spring Awakening, which got a huge boost in recognition with the 2006 Tony Award-winning musical version. It's about the irreparable damage adults can do to kids when they keep information about sex and sexuality quiet or hidden or distorted altogether. At a recent rehearsal of the Coterie production, the cast equates love and addiction in the song, My Junk.
Spend the day wondering what you do, where you go.
I try and just kick it, but then what can I do? We've all got our junk, and my junk is you. See us winter walking out.
Coterie artistic director Jeff Church says linking the anniversary of their education efforts and the play made perfect sense.
It's such a unique piece that continues to obsess everyone who reads it. The text inside the musical is really pretty faithful. Not all of the teenagers end up in a mess. Some do, many do, but some of them kind of have found coping ways. The themes are the same.
Because of the show's mature theme, the Coterie will be staging Spring Awakening only in the evenings for audiences 13 and up. But the day schedule features a show for younger audiences, Dear America, Across the Wide and Lonesome Prairie. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
Spring Awakening at the Coterie Theater at Crown Center runs through September 30th. For more information and photos, go to the Arts and Culture section of the website at kcur.org.
Well, we want to thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents webpage at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter @kccurrents.
Casey Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan and Alex Smith. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Zach Lewandowski is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan.